Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There ought to be a law, but there isn't. Hundreds of thousands of white-collar high-tech and office jobs in the U.S. are moving overseas, and that's what's prompting calls for legislation that would keep those jobs here. The latest stories in the Wall Street Journal talk about IBM shifting workers from places like Poughkeepsie, New York, Southbury, Connecticut, and from Raleigh, North Carolina to Brazil, India, and China. Well, it's easy to see why. A senior programmer at IBM in the U.S. earns about $81 an hour. Someone doing the same work in China bills just over $20 an hour. What's more, the people who study this trend say this is just the beginning of the end for millions of jobs that will eventually move overseas. So what, if anything, can be or should be done to stop this? Are these jobs American jobs, or is this just the way the world works in a global economy? Will it simply be up to America's entrepreneurs to replace these electronic filing and programming jobs with new and creative employment? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have lots of people to hear from today, consultants and reporters and programmers, both here and in India. We're going to start, though, with Christopher Koch. He is executive editor of CIO Magazine, based in Framingham, Massachusetts. Chris, it's nice to have you here in the studio.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Difficult time to be a white-collar worker in one of these jobs in America. Pretty unsettling, I would guess.
It is. You're seeing in IT, I think, what is the beginning of a much larger trend, which is the globalization of the white-collar workforce.
Yeah. How much larger could it become? Because when people talk about thousands of jobs moving overseas last year, this year, what does it mean when there's talk that it could, in fact, become even more than that? How far will it go?
In theory, it could go very far, because what's happened is you have very, very portable technologies, and you've got the internet, and you've got communications costs dropping precipitously, which means that if your knowledge work is portable, there's a good chance that it could go offshore.
I mean, one of the things that I heard about in the past year was the amount of medical work that can go offshore, where you've got a radiologist in India looking at x-rays from hospitals here in Boston. Is that the type of technological development that's going to open it up to more and different kinds of highly skilled jobs moving outside the United States?
Yes, because not only has telecommunications costs gone down a lot, but you also have the issue of technology getting so good that you can ship huge files across the internet that you just couldn't do this years ago. So the internet has made it possible to take very detailed, complex pieces of information and send them abroad.
Now, your magazine is called CIO Magazine, Chief Information Officer Magazine. We contacted a lot of chief information officers in advance of this program, and they weren't too crazy about talking about this. This is becoming quite a politically sensitive issue.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the scenario they envision is their companies offshore this work, and there's such a backlash that rises in this country that they begin boycotting their products.
Let's get a sense of just how the different sides of this are playing out. I want to bring Marcus Courtney in now. Marcus is president of Wash Tech Alliance. That's a local of the Communication Workers of America. Marcus is based in Seattle, Washington. Marcus, you were working in programming through most of the 90s, right?
Yeah, I worked in technical support on Windows 95, and I did testing on Outlook and Office 2000.
Are you one of these programmers who saw his job disappear?
No, I left Microsoft in 1998 in founding Wash Tech, which is the nation's first local union dedicated to organizing and representing high-tech workers over workplace issues. And we focused originally on contracting, and now in the last year we've taken up the exporting of America's best-paying jobs overseas.
Okay, and Dan Pink's also on the line. Dan is a contributor, I should say, to Wired magazine. And Dan, you've got a cover story coming out next month called Kiss Your Cubicle Goodbye. You went to India for this one.
I sure did, because as you're saying, Dick, there's been so much attention to this issue, and the political backlash is so clearly emerging. I wanted to see what the folks in India, the Indian programmers, actually thought about this hubbub in the United States.
And are they carrying guilt on their shoulders for taking jobs away from Americans?
Not too much. I mean, I think there's some empathy for what's happening to the American programmers, but I think the empathy is relatively short-lived. Instead, I think they had, at least to my mind, a rather surprising reaction to what's going on. Among the things that they were saying is they're trying to explode the myth, or at least the myth in their eyes, that the only reason they're getting the work is that they're cheaper. They're arguing that they're also better. And in a way, this rekindles the memories of the time when American manufacturing sector was considered flaccid and unproductive, and an eager and more productive competitor from the East started eating America's lunch. They're also saying something very interesting, too, which is that Americans who are protesting this are being very hypocritical, that if you believe in dynamic capitalism, which has worked so well for so many IT workers, that you have to understand that it works for non-Americans as well. And if you don't, if suddenly when it starts working for somebody else, you say, well, stop the world, I want to get off, you're being a hypocrite.
Well, let's hear from Marcus on that. What about it, Marcus?
Well, first of all, what's really going on is the America's leading companies such as IBM and Microsoft are not exporting these jobs because there's such a great skill advantage in India compared to the U.S. Yes, they're highly educated, highly trained programmers, but they're not more educated and better trained than U.S. programmers. They're explicitly moving due to labor costs. Microsoft's senior vice president, Brian Valentine, in a presentation he gave in July of 2001, said to managers, pick a project offshore today because two heads are cheaper than one. You mentioned the Wall Street Journal article about IBM and focusing on the cost differentials between U.S. programmers and Chinese programmers. Those documents didn't say we need to move over to China and to India because the programming is so much better and the skill base is so greater. We're moving because it's significantly cheaper. And
but Marcus, if you were the senior vice president at Microsoft or IBM and sort of in some kind of cutthroat competition to stay ahead and you could make that kind of savings, wouldn't you be doing the same thing?
Well, first of all, I think the question is also is no, I wouldn't be doing the exact same thing because, for one, we have to recognize that American workers and the American community has built up this industry to be the most successful high-tech industry in the world. And these companies have an obligation not only to their employees but to their communities to provide long-term economic security when these workers are helping provide the benefits and significant success and profits of these companies.
And, Daniel, when you were talking to the workers who are taking this job, these jobs in Mumbai, what were they saying about corporate obligations?
They were actually much more realistic, I think, than Marcus is being about corporate obligations. I mean, you know, I understand where Marcus is coming from, but I think that it's a foolish policy to try to depend on corporate America to maintain the well-being of individual workers. Instead, we should recognize that what's going on is really dynamic capitalism turbocharged, as Chris was saying, by cheap communications and advanced technology, and that the real remedy for the workers who are losing their jobs in the United States are things like wage insurance, universal health insurance, extended unemployment insurance, and not to try to erect walls to keep out the rest of the world. The other thing, which I think is a very interesting question, I pose it for my old friend Marcus, perhaps, is that why do Americans have a higher claim on these jobs than anyone else in the world? I mean, the language that's used to describe this issue is that somehow Indians or Chinese or Filipinos are taking jobs from the United States, that somehow these jobs rightfully belong to Americans, and that anybody who does the job just as well for less money is somehow committing an act of larceny.
Okay, let's hear from Marcus on that.
Well, I think what we have to recognize here is that there's economic self-interest, and that working people and middle-class people in this country want to make sure that they're able to have good-paying jobs with decent benefits. As more and more companies export jobs overseas, in the name of cheap foreign labor, they are threatening America's middle-class ability not only to create new and better-paying jobs in the future, but they're also undermining the economic security of middle-class America when it comes in terms of wages and benefits. And the notion that this is dynamic capitalism, this isn't dynamic capitalism. There's also a raging debate. An economist, Paul Craig Roberts, has come out and said this isn't comparative advantage, what is going on. What this is absolute advantage. And so there's not even even economists are beginning to bait the notion that this is somehow dynamic capitalism and free trade at its best. They're so, trying to say,
Marcus, where does it go from here? You're obviously, you know, expressing a sentiment that a lot of American workers are feeling, but is it going to have to take laws to stop these jobs going overseas? Where does it go from here, from your perspective?
Well, where it goes is that American technology workers and white-collar professionals need to organize. They need to organize for political action to make sure that Congress acts to pass laws and trade agreements to protect the interests of working people and working families. What we need to do is create policies. And Daniel's right. We can't strictly rely on corporate America for this. We need to rely on the government to act in the best interests of working people and create policies to not only protect our job security, our health care and wages, but pass international trade agreements where we can begin exporting products instead of exporting our best-paying jobs.
Marcus,
I just want to add one
okay,
point.
Okay, be quick if you would.
Quick point is that also what's driving this is the H-1 and L-1 visa program, where these companies are able to import guest workers, which are directly replacing American employees, furthering driving down wage rates, and it's increasing the ability of companies to export these jobs overseas.
Ben, we will talk about the visa issue as the program goes on. Marcus, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Marcus Courtney, president of Wash Tech Alliance. And Dan Pink, good to hear from you.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Dan Pink's a contributor to Wired Magazine. You can watch for his cover story, Kiss Your Cubicle Goodbye, in next month's issue. 1-800-423-8255. Of course, we want to hear from you, Connection listeners, on how you see this playing out. I want to come back to Chris Koch here in the studio. Chris is executive editor of CIO Magazine. Is this, Chris, a philosophical argument? Is it simply an economic argument? Is it a political argument? Where's this going?
Yeah, you have to loop all those pieces in here, which is what makes it such a complex issue. You've got economic pieces, you've got labor pieces. Where should I begin? Listening to Marcus is interesting because I think that a lot of IT workers are very angry about what's going on. That's obvious. And I think that they are looking to government to remedy the problems. I think that that's probably not a realistic option, given that both parties have embraced globalization. I think that movement on that front is unlikely. What's interesting is that this is a group that has never organized. You look back to the beginnings of the labor movement in this country, it was a situation similar to this in that the capital side had so much leverage over the labor side that labor organized and wanted to present a countervailing balance.
Quick question, though, and we're coming up to a break, so we'll both have to be brief, but the manufacturing jobs were organized, they were unionized, and those jobs went overseas. So what difference would it have made if the high-tech workers had also been organized in advance of this?
It makes some difference. Some manufacturing jobs have stayed here because of labor unions like the UAW that have been rather more successful than many in negotiating sort of equitable agreements about jobs staying here and jobs going abroad.
All right, Connection listeners, we are talking about jobs staying here and jobs going abroad, the latest political controversy over outsourcing, the export of jobs, offshore workers doing the work that American, educated, white-collar, high-tech people are doing. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you on how you see this playing out. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. In this election year, we're going to hear a lot more about the export of so-called American jobs moving to less developed countries where people who don't spend as much on their lifestyle can do the same work or something comparable for a quarter or a third of what Americans need for their own particular lifestyle. Should U.S. companies say, no, that these jobs need to stay here? Should the government say, no, these jobs must stay here, even if they're only dealing with state contracts? 1-800-423-8255. Let's hear from Peter. Peter's calling in from Clinton, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah.
I have a lot to say say about this. I'm a software developer. I actually started at a company a year ago, and when I started, they had brought in a consultant who had an offshore team working on this project, and it was just a total disaster. They finally pulled the plug on the offshore team, and I'm trying to straighten the mess out now. The problem is, it's not simply writing code. You know, a very short portion of the software development cycle is writing code. Most of it is defining what you want, is writing a specification. And these people in management at this place, they can't tell, you know, they can't tell people what they want. And then if you're going to go and offshore this, send it how many thousand miles away, 12 hours behind, you don't, you know, you're not giving them clear direction. It, you know, that simply doesn't work.
But aren't there just as many success stories, Peter, as there are stories like the one you're describing?
Well, I only speak from my personal experience, and the code was horrible. Every line of code had problems. And, you know, there was a study done, and there was a recent NPR news article, you know, news clip about it, and I guess there was some study done by some economist that said 70% of all people who had done offshore work had canceled the project before they were completed. And only those companies that are very large, that spend a lot of money on management infrastructure in these countries like India and China, were these projects successful at all. I got to find that. I think there was it was on your site somewhere also, so a link to that study. You know, and I think that's very true. I mean, my experience has been it was a disaster. It was doomed to fail from the start. You know, you need the thing about offshoring, it's like using any subcontractor, any consultant. You have to write. You have to communicate very clearly what you want.
Peter, let me step in here if I can. I want to bring Chris in on this because obviously there are failures as well as there are successes. Is this something really that only the monster companies like IBM, who can set up a branch office in Mumbai or in Chennai, have the resources to do well?
At the beginning, that was certainly the case. And you look back to the pioneers in those companies like GE, and others, when they began this, they started very slowly, and they took many years. They built up their capabilities over there. I think things have changed, however, recently. There are more Indian companies that have really come up and are now independently able to offer these services to American companies. Now, I think the caller has a very good point, which is that people tend to overlook the issues of project management in offshoring. And the issue that you need to ramp up. Because what happens when you develop software is generally you do not ship it all off to India. What you have is you've got some Indian programmers working on the project over there. You've got some American managers and some programmers over here also working on the project. Getting those two groups to work together takes time. And I think that what we're seeing is somewhat of the beginnings of what may be a stampede over there that might be ill-advised in the sense that
too many people try to get in on this thing is a good thing. And
they try to do it too fast.
Right.
And what I'm hearing from people who have done this is that you need a good 2-3 years for this to start working. Not only that, but 2-3 years to get the paybacks that you're talking about. And then once you do, you have to factor in all of these extra overhead costs. You need project managers here in the U.S., you need them there in India. You need a lot of transference to make this seamless between two groups working thousands of miles apart. So when you look at the pure labor arbitrage, that's not what goes to the bottom line. You're not saving 90% when you send programming over to India. Our studies show you're saving 20 to absolute outside 40%. Now, that's significant when you're talking thousands of programmers, but
it's not the big bonanza that some people make it out to be.
We've got a bit of a gold rush going on here, and I think you are going to see some failures.
Let's hear from Lance Travis. Lance is Vice President of Outsourcing Strategies at AMR Research. That's a firm based here in Boston. He's joining us on the phone. Lance, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You're doing the middle work here. You're trying to put together American companies that are wondering whether or not they can take some of this work overseas?
Yes. What we do here at AMR Research is we work with large Fortune 1000 companies as well as mid-sized companies and help them develop a strategy about what they could effectively outsource. And I just want to echo some of the things said by some of the earlier speakers that it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. When you look at the vast amount of work that an IT organization does, there are some pieces that can easily or more easily be moved over to a place like India and some pieces that absolutely have to stay domestically. So we work with these companies and help them develop that type of strategy.
Okay, so what's the latest? If I come to you with a mid-sized company that's got a few people in the back office dealing with human resources filings, other people doing code, doing software for my company, what are you saying to people now? Are you saying, this is where everybody's going? You really ought to, take a close second look at whether it's India or Malaysia or China or Brazil. What are you saying to people?
Well, what we say is that there's certainly opportunities to save money, reduce your costs by going offshore, but that you have to be prepared to make an investment in the training and the skills development so that you're successfully doing this, and that it does take a couple of years before you really begin to see the paybacks. So if you're just interested in a one-time quick hit to the bottom line cost savings, you're probably not going to have a successful experience. You're probably not going to see the cost savings that you'd like to see. But if you want to begin to think in terms of global sourcing of your IT strategy and begin to develop an overall strategy, begin to develop the skills in-house necessary to manage those relationships, and begin to really develop your internal processes so that the handoff points from what you do locally and what needs to be done remotely happens as seamlessly as possible, there's a great opportunity.
Now, the last thing that I saw, more than half the Fortune 1000 companies have no relations at all with this sort of outsourcing. And Chris Koch was saying earlier in the program, that means that we could be seeing a whole lot more of this in the years ahead. Is that your advice as well?
Yeah, we certainly expect to see a lot more of this. We, our numbers indicate that somewhere around 20 to 30% of companies today are doing at least some level of pilot project offshore, and we expect to see, that number to grow 40 to 50% in the next 18 months.
Let's bring Susan into the conversation. She's calling in from Cary, North Carolina. And Susan, what do you think about what you're hearing?
Well, there's several things. One, I wanted to just say that I disagree with your guest who said that government intervention isn't a good idea, because I think we've seen that government intervention with manufacturing over, from the 60s and 70s has really helped clean up our air, and that because the government got involved, manufacturing different businesses did put in laws in place to help it make it, help the environment. So companies are designed to not have a conscience. They can't. That's not the way they operate. It's the government will help give a conscience to the way people, businesses are doing business. And second of all, I'd like to say...
So all right, let's take that just for a minute, Susan. Are you saying that the government would then, that one of the companies that goes to see Lance Travis and say, we'd like to move some of this business offshore, that Lance would say, well, first you need a permit from the state or from Washington? How would that intervention work in your mind?
How it would work tactically, I'm not sure. But I do think that laws need to be in place to help keep jobs on this side of the Atlantic and Pacific. How that would be orchestrated, I'm not quite sure. I'm not a legislator. But I do think the government needs to get involved, because the point I'd like to also make is you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. I mean, if people are not working, and we've had friends who have lost their jobs in this area because business, their jobs went overseas to India, then you can't buy products. And if I'm not mistaken, I still think the United States is the largest group of buying products in the world, right?
Susan, I think you're quite right. I think that there is political force on the side of the people who are wondering whether or not this is a good thing. Lance, is that a part of your equation, that there may come some point in the not-too-distant future where governments begin to want to look over your shoulder?
Well, we certainly talk with our clients about the need to be sensitive to these political issues, the need to, even without government regulations, there's a whole set of issues around your employees and how they're going to react to this news, and how you're not going to end up with an entire domestic staff of disgruntled employees. I personally don't think we're going to see a lot of government legislation in this area at the private company level. I mean, certainly, state governments are looking at eliminating the ability to go offshore for government-related projects. But at the private company level, it'd be very difficult to say to IBM, you can't send some of your work overseas when 50% of their business is overseas. They already have offices around the world. They already have tens of thousands of employees around the world.
Chris, you remember back in the late 80s when this country was all in a lather over the Japanese buying up everything that was American? I mean, one of the things that we see from that now is Hyundai, Toyota, Honda manufacturing plants in places like Alabama and Georgia, North Carolina. I mean, well, it's, you know, some people point to that as the type of government intervention where, you know, the problem was solved without anybody feeling that they were really gored. Is that kind of middle ground even available when we talk about the issue at hand here?
Well, I should clarify the point I was making about government intervention. It's not that government intervention in corporate affairs is wrong. As your caller was saying, we do this on the environment, all kinds of other things. But what I'm saying is, when it comes purely from a labor point of view, the government has traditionally stayed hands off on that. That's what differentiates our labor market from others around the world, is that employers are free to hire and fire at will. And all I'm saying is I don't see that going away.
Well, we did see this very administration toss up a protectionist wall on the issue of steel earlier in the administration. I guess
tariffs, different ball
game. But it is the type of intervention.
Yes.
I guess what I'm asking you is, are there any bricks and mortars that allow the government to get involved or give them space to say, no, don't do this?
Well, I think the possible choke point, if you could call it that, would be the visas. But I think that that's a long term, that's not going to have a great impact. What's interesting about Japan is that this was an economy that was basically able to reciprocate. You had a thriving local economy in Japan drove up labor wage rates over there to the point where they were comparable with the U.S., and then the problem went away. You have to look at India and China as a complete different ballgame, and that's has experts worried, in the sense that India's economy is a shambles. Mismanagement from the government and from private enterprise has left it basically unable to create a market of its own internally. And that I think what's increasing the sense of backlash in this country is that its currency is a disaster, and the fact that there isn't a thriving market there that's going to drive up labor wage rates to the point where we can start to get some parity again. You know, you're dealing with a I won't say unfair, but just an unrealistic labor wage differential that's for bad reasons.
But that's always going to be the case, because if India gets its socks pulled up to the point where it's comparable with America, then there'll be a China. There'll be a South American country ready to come in and do the work for less. No?
And that's where you have to think about India and China. I mean, we want these countries to succeed eventually and become partners. It's this transition period. This is the difficulty of globalization. It's that eventually something comes along, traditionally, to replace lost jobs. But it's the transition periods, like when you went from farming to industry. People get caught in that, and you've got to come up with something to help them. And that's where I think the government could intervene with things like cheaper college education, the ability for older people to go back to school easily, the ability for them to transfer their benefits more easily. I mean, if we're going to make these people jump jobs every 6 months, we've got to make it easier for them to move and to move their benefits and go to school.
I want to go back to Lance Travis, who's Vice President of Outsourcing Strategies at AMR Research. Lance, the story that I was looking at recently in the Wall Street Journal about IBM potentially moving thousands of jobs offshore, IBM's just tiptoeing so gingerly around this. They don't want to confirm anything. They don't want to say anything. It's clear that they fear not only some kind of political pressure, but perhaps even an employee backlash, people feeling that they've been let down by IBM. So somewhere in your how-to guide, what does the page say about dealing with employee backlash, if that's going to get worse and worse?
Well, the primary method here is to make sure you have as much open, honest communication as possible. So it's probably not in IBM's best interest to tiptoe around this so much now that this issue has been out in the open. But you really do have to work with the employees, show them what the future is going to be for them. I mean, for a lot of companies that we talk to, when work moves offshore to India, it's not necessarily a one-to-one, we're sending 20 jobs to India, 20 people lose their jobs in the United States. There's still the need to keep the highly skilled people. There's still the need to keep that relationship between the U.S. and India. So typically what we see happening more is a set of work moves to India. Some people get retrained, get reassigned to new projects. Some people do lose their jobs, obviously, in those cases, just like with any layoff or, you know, downsizing type of thing. The more you can do to, you know, ease that for people, and you know, there's very little you can do in a down economy to make losing your job palatable, but certainly, you know, workshops and counseling sessions and things like that go a long way to help.
Lance, let me just step in here. I'd like to bring Teresa on with us. She's calling in from the Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. Teresa, what are you thinking?
Well, I don't think your guests fully understand how angry your unemployed high-tech market is, how angry about these jobs going overseas, and how it impacts Social Security, how it impacts the rest of some of our, hopefully, our laws that protect people who are unemployed. I don't think
Are these people, Teresa, feeling that they have been let down by the country, let down by their corporation? I mean, where's this anger that you're talking about directed, the way you hear it?
Well, they feel strongly that they've been let down by the government, they've been let down by the corporations, and that they're going to start putting the dots together. Corporations pushed for 401ks, which eliminated pension plans, which has impacted Social Security. They're paying for college for their kids, and then their kids get out of college, they can't find jobs, they're over 40, they're 50, they are laid off, they can't get back into the work world no matter what kind of retraining they have because they're too old. These things are really making the workers angry, and you know what? The anger of the older workers is trickling down to the younger workers because they see what their future is going to be like.
Teresa, let me just stop in there. Just a quick question to Lance, because we're close to the end of this part of the program. Lance, are people right to see these as American jobs?
No, I don't believe they are. And we're talking about a global economy here. We're talking about jobs that are effectively require high skills, high education, and there are people throughout the world with those skills, and the products, the results of that work are sold throughout the world.
So. All right, Lance, I'm out of time. I want to thank you for being with us on this part of the program.
Well, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Lance Travis, Vice President of Outsourcing Strategies at AMR Research. Teresa, thanks a lot for that call. Our number, 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you as we talk about this controversy. Shipping jobs overseas. Are they American jobs? Who belongs or who owns them? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio, Chris Koch. He is executive editor of CIO Magazine. And we're talking this hour about jobs that are moving from this country to other countries, high-tech jobs, medical jobs, perhaps even legal jobs, and others, other white-collar work in the months and the years ahead. We're joined also on the line now by Aarti Ramesh. She's director of business development at Niyati Technologies in Chennai, India. She's been listening along to the program. Aarti, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Tell me what it is that you want from the United States. Your website says, look, we've got a large talent pool, no shortage of skilled workers, college-educated, English-speaking. What are you looking for?
To begin with, I'd like to introduce my company. We are a small, mid-sized, new generation technology company, and we specialize in integrated services for businesses. We offer services to do with design, whether it is user interface design, website design, multimedia, 3D animation, print design.
Aarti, I need you to tell me whether or not you're working with people like Lance Travis in saying, no, we can do certain work that is now being done in the United States. Is that where your business is going to come from?
Yes, please. Yes, we have an online presence which talks to the countries abroad, away from India. asking them to outsource business to us because we are able to, because we have an availability of talented resources.
Now, you hear people on this program arguing about whether or not these are American jobs or not. A lot of our callers think they are. What do you think?
The way we operate is we think this is a global market. Now, I was just hearing Lance say it's a global economy. I think because it's a global market and it's boundaryless and business happens at a click of a button, Indians have just upgraded skills to compete in the global market. And we have become a global supplier with capabilities to supply goods and services at a competitive price.
Artie, what do you say to people in this country who say, though, that it's not fair, that workers like yours are stealing jobs away from Americans? What do you say to those people?
I just think that it is a global market, and anyone who has the skill and the education and can handle the job as well as an American can is allowed to participate in the process of pitching for the business.
Artie, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're most welcome, sir.
Artie Ramesh, Director of Business Development at Niyati Technologies. Chris Koch, It's a global marketplace. Can you get away from that? Can you introduce into that the whose job is it argument, or does it always end up with, you know, the job is going to go where the best work can be done for the least amount of money?
Yeah, it's on an emotional level, you can say that this is an American industry, and I think that's what has people angry. There is no competing technology industry abroad. It was created here, it grew here, and a vast majority of the work goes on here. When you think about where does software come from, it comes from the United States. That's part of what has people angry. But in a broader sense, I think this is the anger that other white-collar people are beginning to feel who are seeing the same thing happen to them, which is, in fact, you know, I've talked to a lot of IT workers. They are very angry. And I've talked to one guy who was, this is his second round of globalization. He worked at a factory in Connecticut. And it was shut down, and it was sent overseas. And so, what he heard from politicians and economists was that the future of the American economy is knowledge work. Get a college degree, you're going to get a job, you're going to share the wealth. And these people did, and they did share the wealth for a while. But now they're seeing the same thing happen again, and they're saying, "Okay, where is the government in this? They were telling us they feel cheated."
There is a little piece in Daniel Pink's forthcoming article in Wired where he talks to Shirley Turner, a state senator in New Jersey, and he makes exactly the same point. He says, you know, America went from the farm to the factory and people had to shift. And then they went from the factory to knowledge work and people had to shift. And so Daniel says to her, now we're moving from knowledge work to whatever comes next. And she leans across the desk and she says, well, what does come after knowledge work?
Well, exactly. You're laid off from a factory. Your skills are pretty portable because they're low skills. You can go to retail. The service economy is what saved this economy after the manufacturing jobs started going offshore. When you're talking about white-collar work, an IT programmer, you know, what are the growth industries? Healthcare? If you are a college-educated IT worker making $75,000 a year, to go into healthcare with that kind of salary, you're looking at a serious amount of re-education. So it's going to be much more difficult for these people to get jobs again. That's another fear and anger that they have. They feel they paid their dues on education already.
To Boston, Massachusetts now. Jennifer is joining us. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
What are you thinking as you listen along?
Well, I couldn't agree with the person who just spoke anymore. In fact, I think he just expressed all my sentiments. I have been retrained after being laid off in the paper publishing world. It was considered one of those industries going away along with timber. I got retrained into web publishing, and then I, as a writer, decided to develop my skills in technical writing, which was a huge thing with the Society for Technical Communication. And now I'm seeing all these jobs go overseas.
Are you still working now, Jennifer?
I am. I've been in a pharmaceutical company. I've switched over to healthcare, but I've been able to do some of my normal trade in this healthcare industry. And now I'm in sales. So it's a far cry from where I started, and it certainly wasn't my original career plans, but at this point I'm happy with my company.
Are you making less money now than you anticipated you would when you got into technical writing high tech?
I'm not making any less than I thought I would, but I think my major concern is that I'm hearing about President Bush going out and wanting to give money now to community colleges in Ohio, and I know how bad the economy there is, and I'm wondering, he says it's money for retraining, especially for information systems jobs, when I have so many friends that I actually worked with that don't even have jobs right now.
So where's this going?
I think they're all going overseas. So I'm wondering, what is this retraining money going to actually do? And I think that's where the sentiments of your last talk or your last speaker went.
Yeah, it's Chris Koch. And I'll come back to you, Chris, on this. I actually listened to the president talking on the radio this morning, and he said, you know, we used to do retraining where we'd, you know, shut down a factory and train 1,000 beauticians for 50 jobs. And what good was that? And we need to be way smarter in our retraining. Can that be done when we talk about something as precise and highly skilled and with people having the expectations they do?
That is the, education is the only answer, but that's a big problem. That's going to take a lot of work. We've got, you look at the education systems in India and China, these kids are going to college for very little money. The postgraduate schools in India, and I'm not as sure about China, but I know in India, they are approaching parity levels with some of the best technology schools here in the U.S., like MIT and Stanford. Look at an American college kid. He or she has to think about $250,000 to get through that same program that an Indian student is getting through at a fraction of the price. We've got to think about how to do that. Another suggestion that people have had is, we do, in fact, have the best software developers per capita, to put it that way. We need to make this a super profession, and I think that other white-collar professions may start thinking the same way, in that using education as a competitive weapon is a way to get around all the political issues that complicate this.
See, I'm not so sure it's going to be that easy. I used to live and work in India, and I'd see these kids at their college courses and in their high schools, and they're unbelievably committed. The hours that they put in, the way that it's hammered into them that this is your way up and out. This isn't just, you know, what's going to give you a comfortable home in the suburbs. Your job's going to end up rescuing this whole family.
Well, exactly. And here in the U.S., it's the opposite. We have the culture celebrates achievement over there and in China as well. And here, you're called a geek, and you get a year's life's worth of neurosis. We have to change the view of achievement in this country and really start celebrating kids who get into math and science, because that's our future. And there is one way that you can look at this, which is the professionalization of IT. By that, I mean you've got programs for lawyers, you've got programs for doctors that are specifically targeted to create essentially a super educated, super ready person to practice these jobs. We don't have that in IT. You go through college, you get a degree, you go out and fiddle around with programming. I think schools like MIT and Stanford could start doing something along the lines of a legal degree or a medical degree with IT to say, we're going to turn out the best programmers in the world, right, bar none. It's what gives us our edge in healthcare.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Boston, and Rajini is joining us. Did I pronounce your name right, Rajini?
Pretty good, I think.
All right. What are you thinking?
A couple of things. A lot of people have mentioned anger, you know, the anger of the American worker who's lost his or her job. And it's really the anger that concerns me, because in all of the rhetoric that we've heard from our politicians, there's a kind of demonization of certain nations, principally in Asia. Whereas, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're also exporting jobs to places like Ireland and Israel and New Zealand, perhaps not in as large numbers as we are to India and China. So the first thing I want to sort of emphasize is, let's not demonize only particular nations, because there are repercussions for people of those nations who live here, just as we saw in the Vincent Chin case in 1982 when, you know, Japan was being demonized and a young Chinese-American man was killed because he was mistaken as a Japanese auto worker. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the point I want to make. And the second thing is I really appreciate Chris Koch's comments, because I think he's trying to complicate the picture by talking about the ways in which, you know, corporations perhaps ought to be responsible, but the ways in which it's unrealistic for us to expect corporations that have been raised on the philosophy of laissez-faire capitalism to even consider their responsibility. So really, it is the government that should be stepping in.
Regina, I want to, if I can, take the first part of what you were saying and turn to Chris with that, because I think it's a really important point to keep in mind that this kind of scampering around the globe in search of who can do what work. It's all over the European Union. There are many American corporations who, you know, will outsource to Fredericton, New Brunswick, or Halifax, Nova Scotia, not necessarily Bangalore. I mean, American car companies like to have their cars made in southern Canada because they don't have to pay health care. So it's part of a bigger puzzle, isn't it, that Regina's talking about?
Yes, it is. I think, again, it gets back to the issue of, is government responsible? Can government help? I think that the thing that gets left out of this whole debate is the fact that labor unions in the U.S., especially among the kind of people we're talking about here, white-collar workers, have been discredited. They're viewed as corrupt. They're viewed as a drag on society. Like any myth, there's some element of truth in that. But I think workers, for example, who have organized, and it's happening mostly on the internet with IT workers. They've gotten together and they say, what do we do? We have an organization, but they're careful to say it's not a union. If it's not a union, what is it? You have to come up with an organization that is able to gather force, is able to bargain with corporations. And I think it's unrealistic for people to simply expect the government to step in. I'm not saying it's not wouldn't be a good thing to do to save people's jobs, absolutely. But in the past, people have dealt with this through labor organizations. That's
okay,
how they
but
deal
but
with it.
We go back
in Europe
to what Teresa was saying earlier in the program. She's saying, you know, there's political muscle here as well. Is
absolutely
that where we're going to see it expressed?
If it grows large enough, yes, because these people vote a lot more than low-skilled workers do. They tend to be conservative. They tend to be white. So
it's also a useful hot button political thing to push in an election year too, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And there's precedent for, and there's wages are already starting to go down for IT workers because of the global pressure. I mean, we're seeing it. It's out there.
Here in the United States.
Yes, yes.
We're going to be following it. I want to thank you for coming in to help us through this hour, Chris.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Christopher Koch, executive editor of CIO Magazine. Earlier in the program, we talked with Marcus Courtney, president of WashTech Alliance, Dan Pink, author of the forthcoming Wired Magazine cover story, Kiss Your Cubicle Goodbye. Lance Travis from AMR Research was here, as was Arti Ramesh from Niyati Technology, based in Chennai, India. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.